session number 16782, real one.
Commander Gedge, real one. Where were you born, please?
I was born in London on the 1st of March 1943.
Where did you grow up in London?
And then I grew up in Warwickshire for the first 15 or 18 years of my life.
Which town or village was that?
That was initially in near to Solihull, and then after that in Leamington Spa.
What was your rank and job when the Falklands crisis broke out, please?
When the Falklands crisis broke out, I was a lieutenant commander, and I had just spent about 2 years in command of the first frontline Sea Harrier squadron. In fact, I'd handed that over in January of 1982, and I then spent 6 weeks or so on the staff of the admiral who was organizing and concerned with the running of the carriers and the bigger ships.
Had you had any active service experience?
I'd had active service to a limited extent in initially right at the end of the Malayan confrontation in the 60s, and then also a little bit in the Aden operations in Aden in the later 60s. But apart from that, that was only the really times I'd flown armed aeroplanes.
What was the basic character of those operations?
Of the original operations, they were... Malayan operations were, I suppose, counterinsurgency, but the Aden were really providing a presence in case of attacks by the Yemenis into the what was then the Protectorate of Aden.
When you say counterinsurgency, was that ground attacks?
Yes, in fact, we didn't actually really see any action. We just flew. We were available in case of need. So the Falklands, when it came, was going to provide. I mean, when the whole thing started, it was going to provide the first real test, as far as I was concerned, of what we had spent. And in my case, I'd been flying almost exactly 20 years when the Falklands came along.
So how did you react to the prospect of going into action?
Well, I think I think everybody involved reacted with some trepidation. There's always a great sense of the unknown. I think people I've spoken to all over would bear this out. When prior to action, maybe fear is the wrong word to use, but I think everybody is apprehensive, maybe a lot are fearful, but there is simply a huge element of unknown. You just have no idea what is going to happen. And more particularly, perhaps, you have no idea how you yourself are going to react, and that's probably the biggest unknown, I think, for most people.
Had you expected a crisis to break over the Falklands?
No, it was totally unexpected. As I said, I'd been flying for the best part of, for 20 years. I'd had command of the first Sea Harrier Squadron. I'd handed that over, and I'd gone into a staff job, so I was... The last thing I was expecting at that stage was actually to be flying an aeroplane, or, for that matter, to be involved in any action. I got involved in the flying because it was very apparent as soon as we started winding things up for the Falklands that we were going to be very short of Sea Harriers. And in the initial action was to send two carriers and virtually all the Sea Harriers we had available in frontline squadrons down south, and they were deployed within a few days really of the whole Falklands starting. And as soon as that had happened, there was a very real need to think about how we were going to provide replacement aircraft for attrition purposes, or as backups to those that had already deployed. And so that was the stage that I really was brought back into the fold. And in fact, I was asked to come back and form a new squadron. And I formed 809 Squadron. My initial remit was to bring together all the aircraft that we could muster from all over the place, all the Sea Harriers, some of which were in weren't yet in service. They were in really advanced stages of build at that stage. My remit was to bring it all together, form a squadron, and then be ready for deployment or whatever was required in as short a time as possible. Now, within the first few days of going to Yeovilton and forming this squadron, the general pattern became clearer, and in fact the rather open remit that I'd been given on day one was translated into reality of actually deploying with a number of aircraft in 3 weeks. The method of deployment was quite interesting because we had no more aircraft carriers at that stage. And so the idea was conceived of converting a merchant ship. And the merchant ship that was procured was the container vessel Atlantic Conveyor, which was diverted from its normal duties. It was taken up from trade by the Royal Navy, brought around to Devonport, and in the course of 8 days, I think it was, the ship was converted, fully stored, and was ready for the first of class flying trials, which I in fact conducted myself. And it was a fascinating period. I mean, as an indication of the kind of the scale of things that were going on, I went down on I think it was a Saturday morning, and went around with two or three others, and we walked around the deck, literally deciding there and then where the flying deck, part of the deck, should be constructed for the Sea Harrier, how the containers would be arranged on the decks in order to provide some sort of weather and wind break for the other aircraft that were going to be stored there. And we were making very fundamental decisions, like should we take away the foremost or should we leave it? Should we, which of the deck fittings should we leave and which would we remove? And within about 2 hours, all these decisions had been made. I was on board for about, I think, 4 hours that Saturday morning. And by the end of the 4 hours, there were large teams of people already cutting away the deck structures that we wanted removed and already lifting in vast sheets of steel in order to construct the flying deck. Now that, as I say, was on a Saturday. The following Sunday, a week later, I actually flew down from Yeovilton, landed on board Atlantic Conveyor, which was swinging round a buoy in Plymouth Sound, and conducted the first of class flying trials from it. I did about 4 or 5, maybe 6 landings on it from various directions, at the end of which I, and each one of course was a vertical landing and a vertical takeoff, and I approached from different directions, and at the end of that I was able to climb up and radio back to Yeovilton that the ship was satisfactory. In fact, then I landed at Plymouth Roeburgh Airport to refuel and then went back to Yeovilton. Now, within about an hour of leaving Atlantic Conveyor and refueling at Roeburgh on way back to Plymouth, I noticed that Atlantic Conveyor was already had slipped her moorings and was on her way, and she was actually on her way to the South Atlantic, having been approved as an aviation-capable ship. I mean, that was just a small indication of the kind of speed that things were happening in.
What happened next?
Well, from my point of view, the next event was the actual decision to how many aircraft we would take down with us to the South Atlantic, and then how we would get there, because the ship, Atlantic Conveyor was essentially taking down a huge amount of equipment and stores. I mean, there was instant runway materials. There were a number of boats. There was a lot of construction material. There was a tented city for some thousands of people. All sort of additional equipment to that which had already been sent down with the fleet. And in addition to the these materials, which are all obviously stored, being a container ship, there's a huge amount of space, and they were all stored down below. There were a number of aircraft. There were Chinook aircraft, Royal Air Force, a number of Wessex helicopters, and we wanted to put a number of Royal Air Force Harrier aircraft in addition to the Royal Naval Sea Harrier aircraft on board. I mean, the reason we needed all these extra Sea Harriers was because we were just very short of Sea Harriers, and we were expecting to there was a possibility of actually losing aircraft in if there was going to be any action. I think all of us who were involved were actually expecting action. Now, thinking back to the time that this was the early part of April, around about the middle of April at this stage. The country at large, I think, was still not expecting us to go to war. I think a lot of those involved in the ships probably weren't expecting us to go to war. It was, at that stage, it was still a show of strength. From my point of view, I was, I think, in no doubt in my mind that actually we were going to go to war. I'm not quite sure what gave me that impression, but it was certainly something that was, at that stage, was quite apparent to me that this was going to be for real. So all my thoughts and energies were actually given to getting us to the highest possible state of readiness. So what in fact the plan that we evolved was to allow let the Atlantic Conveyor proceed south. I mean, she had 3,000 odd miles to go to Ascension Island, which was halfway. And our plan was then to fly ourselves down to Ascension Island, meet up with Atlantic Conveyor, and then passage from Ascension Island down to the Falklands in the ship. And so this gave us a breathing space. The passage for Atlantic Conveyor was, I can't quite remember, I mean, something like 10 days or so down to Ascension. So in fact, we continued with our working up of the new squadron that I'd formed at Yeovilton. And we had quite a task. I mean, we not only had to, there were new aircraft, we had in many cases to actually complete the putting together of the aircraft. I mean, the actual airframes were built, but in some cases they didn't have radars in them, and so on. So the aircraft had to be completed. In most cases they were repainted, and we also had the problem of working up aircrew, and we had to provide some sort of cohesive maintenance support team, and then we also were trying to provide some sort of ongoing capability to carry out really quite a large number of trials of new equipments that we wanted to we thought we might need if whatever action was going to happen did in fact materialize. And so the bottom line of all this was that we decided we would deploy with 8 aircraft, leaving 2 aircraft behind for trials purposes. These were 8 Sea Harriers. We had already decided we would take a number, I think there were again 8 Royal Air Force Harriers with their pilots. So my squadron, which was 809 squadron at this stage, would be 8 aircraft, 8 pilots. We decided to take 12 maintenance personnel down in South in Atlantic Conveyor. And the plan when we actually got down to the area with the other two carriers off the Falklands was then to probably to deploy my aircraft into one of the ships, or maybe to split them between the two ships, and that would depend on what had happened at that stage. So that end of the plan was left pretty open. And in the event, towards the end of April, we then flew the eight aircraft down to Ascension, in fact in in-flight refueling, and we made a decision that actually we would stop on the way, and we stopped in Gambia overnight, refueling, if I remember rightly, I think about I think we refueled nine times on the way down to Gambia, and about four times from Gambia down to Ascension. The actual number of times we refueled was simply to keep the tanks of the aircraft really topped up to the highest possible level. In fact, it was unnecessary to refuel that number of times, but it gave us the most options should anything happen. And the interesting part about that, I mean, we were actually breaking new ground in a lot of what we were doing, and of course this was the first time we'd done any long-distance refueling. In fact, it was the first time that a lot of us had ever refueled, air-to-air refueling. So it was that was another reason for keeping the tanks fully topped up.
And then when you reached mid-Atlantic?
Well, when we got to Ascension, we then had a slight pause. The Atlantic conveyor was, I think she still hadn't arrived, actually. She was within a day or two of arriving. But there was quite a lot of what military terms was called consolidation going on. There was a huge amount of load lifting from the various ships that were down there. The amphibious ships were there, and a lot of other shipping was passing through, and so there was a huge amount of helicopter lift going on of stores and personnel from one ship to another. And in fact, I spent about a week in Ascension with my little team, in the course of which the RAF replacement Harriers arrived down there as well. And then at the end of all this, we put together the plan for actually flying all these aircraft on board Atlantic Conveyor and getting them stowed. Now that was a pretty interesting task in itself, because a lot of the people involved had never ever deck landed an aeroplane before. I mean, they were all vertically landing, obviously, but the mere fact that they were landing on a ship at sea and the size and shape of the deck they were landing on was different from a pad ashore, which of course the Royal Air Force were used to landing on confined areas and on metal pads in muddy fields. But this was a new experience for all of them, and it was a new experience for some of my pilots as well. So we had a deal of discussion about this and teach-in before people went off. In the event, it was it all worked very satisfactorily, and we embarked everybody and then set off to the South Atlantic almost within hours of the last aircraft being on board. On the way down, and we had about 2 weeks passage to the Falklands area. This was the stage, of course, when a huge amount was going on. The realization, I think, had then dawned on everybody that this was a real operation and not just simply a show of strength. And so there was I think the mood was perceptibly changing. I think people were being rather more serious about what they were doing and how they were thinking about things. And certainly in Atlantic Conveyor, we were taking a real interest in what we were going to be doing and how we would go about it. Quite a lot of our time was given over to teaching ourselves and trying to pass on information about naval operations to the Royal Air Force people who were with us. And as I've said, it was their first time deck landing aircraft in ships at sea, and of course most of them had no conception at all about really what naval operations were about. I mean, they were well used to training for flying off airfields and ashore. Very good at their task, which was ground attack. But most of them had, I think, little conception probably of really what fighting an air war 8,000 miles away from home, from ships at sea, was going to be all about. And so we spent that fortnight in really quite a concentrated set of sort of teach-ins and lectures and discussions about everything we could think of. So in that sense, it was quite a valuable period. And the other rather interesting thing, and again we were really breaking new ground here, was that we decided we would keep a Sea Harrier on continuous armed alert on Atlantic Conveyor, just in case of attack. Atlantic Conveyor, of course, was a merchant ship. It was unarmed. So the only armament on board was the Sea Harriers, and we had our war stock missiles with us, guns loaded. So in fact we kept a Sea Harrier as long as we could actually on a ready to go at a few minutes notice. In the event we didn't get a chance to use it, and I always sort of smiled slightly to myself in recollection, because in fact it was a great pity that had we been able to actually launch the Sea Harrier and maybe even shoot at something, that would have been very much a first for a vertical takeoff aircraft to actually go into action off a merchant ship. But in the event it was it very nearly happened. The nearest we came to it, I think, was the time the Argentines were using 707 aircraft for surveillance purposes, and there was some discussion, of course, about whether these were commercial and civilian aircraft or whether they in fact were military. And initially we would not have had approval to actually shoot at this aircraft had it come within range. I think latterly, had it appeared, once it was known to be being used for military purposes, I think we would have, if it had actually come within range, we would have launched. But it was an interesting period, as I say, and it allowed all of us to come to grips with what we were doing. And the passage down was about 2 weeks, at the end of which the decision had been made that we would actually split my squadron in two parts. This was really based on the losses that it was based really on the room that there was in the particular ships, and we had already lost some Sea Harriers, not to enemy action at this stage, but to just in the course of normal flying operations. And so I myself went to the Invincible and the other and with three other aircraft, and the other four went to HMS Hermes. Having transferred to the two ships, of course, we were in a wholly different scene. The Atlantic Conveyor had been a very calm and tranquil existence. We had been not totally out of touch with what had been going on, but of course, as a merchant ship, she was not equipped with anything other than fairly rudimentary communications. And so the actual day-to-day happenings in the Falklands were, to a very great extent, were lost to us. We had listened to the BBC World Service, so we were up with a sort of overall picture of what was going on. But the real sort of priority naval communications traffic that happens once you're in any sort of operation was totally denied to us. My recollection, stuck in my mind since then. My recollection of actually the initial transfer was from Atlantic Conveyor was interesting, and we launching the aircraft was really no problem, except that I witnessed, I think, what to me was one of the nearly one of the most catastrophic accidents, where one of the pilots who hadn't actually launched off a naval ship before actually got the nozzles pointing in the wrong direction when he applied the power. And of course, the one thing with a Sea Harrier is that once you add full power, everything happens rather quickly, and the aircraft goes in the opposite direction to what the nozzles are pointing in. Clearly, you have to point the nozzles down in a Sea Harrier if you're going to go upwards. If you have the nozzles pointing in any other direction, you will go sideways or up at an angle, and this is exactly what happened. He went off at about 45 degrees, and with great presence of mind, he managed to recover the situation, but it was a total heart stopper for all of us that were on board. And I was standing there with a microphone on the bridge, totally unable to give any advice. It was all happening so quickly. But that's an aside. I flew onto the Hermes initially, which was close at hand. I mean, it was within two or three cables of Atlantic Conveyor at that stage. And there was then inevitably a wait. I refueled in Atlantic Conveyor, and night was falling, and it wasn't quite clear whether we were going to stay in Atlantic Conveyor or go on to Invincible. The decision was made very late on, in fact, as dusk was falling, and it was virtually dark at this stage. To my surprise, it was decided I would go to Invincible then. Now, although I'd done quite a bit of night flying from carriers, it was some months since I'd last night flown from a ship at sea, and so I was slightly surprised at this. I was quite prepared to do it, of course, but it was an interesting experience. And I realized that actually once I was airborne, there were one or two very basic things that I really didn't know about. The first of which was I was flying in a war zone, and I wasn't sure in my own mind whether I would put the navigation lights and anti-collision lights on the aircraft, which are normally bright and flashing when you fly around in peacetime to avoid collision with other aircraft. I wasn't sure in my own mind whether I would actually put these on, bright and flashing, or whether I would turn them off. It occurred to me that I had one frequency only, and that was the ship that I was going to. I had a rough idea where it was, but I hadn't a clue about any of the other sort of the situation around me. I didn't know whether there was a threat of enemy aircraft at this stage, or whether I'd had no briefing at all on the situation. In the event, I decided that the best thing was to be extremely cautious, and I put the lights on bright and flashing on the basis that if that would probably make people wonder why an aircraft was there looking for all intents and purposes like a normal peacetime aircraft. And I flew some, I think, well over 200 miles to where I'd been told Invincible was, by which time it was pitch dark, very black. Called them up, and to my great relief I got a reply and was able to do an approach to the carrier and land on it. Now, the actual arrival was uneventful, and my lack of practice wasn't too apparent, I think, but there was a certain amount of surprise on board, because they hadn't actually been expecting another aircraft, and when a Sea Harrier suddenly arrives from out of the black night when you're in a war zone and 8,500 miles from home, and you're not expecting it, there was a certain amount of incredulity, I think, when they saw me. Anyway, be that as it may, they gave me a very warm welcome, and that was the first then of the actual operational part. It was the following day that the rest of my aircraft actually caught up with me, and then we set about the whole business of integrating ourselves into the ship operations. In the event, we decided that rather than run two separate squadrons on board, that what I would do would be to integrate my